dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war has, of course, had a searing new front opened with the devastating fire in the holy place of Notre Dame, the cathedral, the magnificent Christian cathedral in the heart of Paris. It's not yet known its cause, but I'm very pleased to say we have with us a man who has been very closely monitoring the environment in France, which raises a suspicion, as yet unproven, but a suspicion nonetheless, that this may have been an act deliberately taken to desecrate and, if possible, destroy this treasure. And it's happened again and again and again in his native France. His name is Michel Gerfinkel. He is a periodic contributor to this program. We're very pleased to catch up with him in Israel. He is the founder and president of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute, which is a conservative think tank in France, and a Shulman Ginsberg Fellow at the Middle East Forum in the United States, as well as the editor-at-large of Valeur Actuelle, which is a conservative newsweekly in France. Michel, I am sorry to say that we are talking with you on this particular occasion, but I'm otherwise, as always, very pleased to catch up with you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, my friend.
It's my pleasure.
So you were, as I understand it, on your way to Israel, but still in France when this disaster took place in Paris, the fire that destroyed much of this remarkable facility, this beautiful house of worship. What were your thoughts as it happened?
I was packing and intending to take a plane later on, early in the morning, when, in fact, the BBC in London called me to get my impression on what was going on. And at that point, I was not aware that the fire had erupted at Notre Dame. But all I had was to open my window, since I live not far away from Notre Dame, and I could see, you know, a column or a pillar of smoke of biblical proportion rising above the cathedral. It was very, very impressive. And then a few moments later, we heard about the fall of the spire, which again struck everybody in Paris and in France as something impossible. You know, Notre Dame was so much part of the landscape of Paris and of France that you would never have figured out such a thing to happen.
Of course, it wasn't just part of the landscape. It was part of the history and the culture and, well, the Christian heritage of France as well. And what did you make of the announcement while the fire was still going on by the authorities of France that it was not an act of arson, but an accident?
This is absolutely ridiculous. You cannot ask any man who has been working on such matters, anybody associated with the police forces and so on. Nobody can tell what really happened when things are still in the process of happening and so on. And if I trust the French press today, a team of 50 policemen, police commissioners and inspectors has been commissioned to survey the entire, to investigate the entire case. And they have not been allowed so far to enter the cathedral, allegedly for security reasons. And I think that's a good reason not to allow them to enter the place. But how can you definitely say that it was not an arson and it was just due to technical problems that the fire spread? Now, if I am to believe another interesting opinion, which has been expressed by the former engineer-in-chief of the works at Notre Dame, he just said today in an interview with the press that according to, you know, the wall pattern of the woods used for the roofs of the cathedral and so on, he could not possibly understand how the fire spread so quickly. It was technically impossible in his opinion. So apparently this authorized opinion is that there is something suspicious about the fire.
Well, I think there's a lot suspicious, but it's interesting to have that insight. Quickly, Michel, tell us about the context in which this is taking place. This, whatever the provenance of this particular incident, there have been myriad attacks on churches in France, as I understand it, as many as two a day in 2018 on average. Is that right?
There has been a very strange acceleration of anti-Christian attacks over the past months and years. You always had a few very, you know, rare cases of desecration. You always have all kind of weird people who, for some reason or for another reason, will do some act of vandalism or desecration directed at Christian churches and shrines. Now, over the past years, there has been an acceleration of very ominous things. Remember that about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, a priest was slaughtered while saying the Mass, celebrating the Mass in Normandy by an Islamist fanatic. And we have also a lot of evidence, a lot of reports that a lot of churches and a lot of Christian tombs in French cemeteries have been desecrated over the past months. It has been accelerating at a very rapid pace over the last year or so.
And Michel, is it fair to say that in most cases, or at least many cases, the perpetrators of these attacks are, in fact, well, what I think of as Sharia supremacists who are acting out, you know, what they're called to do to force the submission of Christians and others?
To be entirely honest, we don't know, because these kind of attacks have been done under the cover of the night, and we have no evidence as to who did it.
How could that possibly be, given the frequency with which this is happening?
This is something that should have been investigated, and I understand that it is under investigation, and probably some of the early conclusions may point to what you just said. But what I'm trying to say, and this is more important, is that if you go to the Muslim website or social media in France, you see that, in fact, a lot of Islamists, in fact, are happy about such desecration of Christian places to happen.
There was jubilation over this incident in Notre Dame, for sure.
So there might be a link.
Michel, we don't have time to talk about what's being done to Jews in France as well. That will be for another day. But thank you so much for your eyewitness account on what has just gone down in France with this terrible tragedy at Notre Dame. And we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's my pleasure to say we are joined, as we are just about every week, by Diana West. She is an author. She is an essayist. She is a brilliant researcher and thinker about the challenges Western civilization is facing from enemies foreign and domestic, and what the stakes are if we lose what I call the war for the free world. Diana is, of course, the author of three very important books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, I'm proud to say, a publication of the Center for Security Policy Press, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. You can find Diana's writings at dianawest.net and The Daily Caller and other places as well. Always pleased to have her with us. Diana, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
So, one of the things that is on your mind as I perused your dianawest.net site is one that is on mine as well. Namely, what are we to make of the fact that before the fire was even out in Notre Dame Cathedral, the authorities in France were telling us there was no evidence of arson? I've had law enforcement professionals with a lot of experience tell me that that's not possible to do until you're actually on the ground, you know, able to exhume evidence of, flammable materials or devices that would have set them off and that sort of thing, let alone while the fire is still, you know, underway. So what do you make of what's happening here, Diana?
Well, this drew my eye and ears and everything else. As I was watching, as the world was watching this tragedy of the conflagration and the narrative being laid. I mean, this essentially was crowd control in its most crude and nonsensical form. Everyone, you don't even need to be a skilled law enforcement officer. Most of us could figure out that you cannot tell what's going on inside a burning building until the fire is out. And so, yes, this was really an insult to people watching this happen, hear the authoritarian voices say, it's not arson, it's not terrorism, it's an accident, starting to impugn all a number of French craftsmen and so on who've been working on this big renovation that was underway or not even underway.
Not even underway.
Not even underway.
And certainly not underway at the hour when this incident took place, which told like 2 hours before all of the workmen were gone. So, Diana, the point for me, in addition to, you know, the insult to our intelligence, as you say, is that we've been encouraged to ignore what has been happening in France with great regularity. In fact, I just learned yesterday that the number of attacks on churches in France in 2018 was on average 2 a day. So there's a pattern here, and maybe this is a part of that pattern. Maybe it's an outrider. We don't know just yet, but it certainly warrants discussion as to what is going on against these houses of Christian worship in a Christian, or at least until recently, Christian nation like France, and at the hands of whom? And what you talk about in your blog posting at dianawest.net, the instance at Fox News in which 2 different individuals were precluded from talking about that. Discuss that, if you would.
Yes. Well, this was very shocking to behold because it was not just one anchor, it was 2. It was Shepard Smith and it was Neil Cavuto with 2 different guests. One, a French official on the Shepard Smith show, Philippe Carcenti, and then Bill Donahue of the very important Catholic group in America, both of whom were trying to make the point that you just made, that we are looking at a pattern of attack on the various Catholic churches in France 2 a week, we find. I didn't know that until this news managed to come out.
2 a day, not a week, 2 a day.
Yeah, 2 a day. I mean, this is incredible. This was an effort to suppress our common sense, our logical faculties, in terms of trying to place what was going on into possible context. Was it an accident? Was it arson? The anchors were clearly under instructions not to place it into any sort of context of this large-scale attack on Christianity in France, but to make it some sort of outlier that we could just put down to carelessness. This was, not truth-seeking, not journalism, not anything good.
Not even reserving judgment until we could possibly have a basis for rendering that judgment. I mean, this is really unprofessional. And you know, Diana, I just have to say, I mean, you follow these things scrupulously, the sort of culture wars, I guess you might call them, as well as the civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood calls it. And, you know, I'm just mindful that those 2 Fox News anchors were responding in their ways in the aftermath of what I call the penalty box treatment that Judge Jeanine Pirro was given for daring to connect the dots between Ilhan Omar's anti-Semitism and her Sharia supremacists inclinations. I mean, this can't have been lost on the hosts, probably on the guests as well, for in most cases at Fox News, don't you think?
I would think so. I mean, this is that chilling effect that we've been looking at and experiencing and watching develop over these many years now, since 9/11, when discussions of Islam suddenly became very verboten, and certainly to an extreme now on Fox News, where you can't even discuss this pattern of attack on Catholic churches in France while we're watching the greatest church in France of all going down in flames. Whether it is arson, whether it is an accident, of course, unknown, although what we also learned was we were all supposed to believe it is an accident. This becomes one of these Orwellian moments. It's beyond Orwell. It becomes one of these Soviet Pravda information, disinformation war moments where people are being manipulated and conditioned to make a certain response to a disaster. And we have to only look back a few years to the Bataclan attack in Paris, where we saw the authorities doing everything they could to prevent the absolute horrors of what happened to the people caught by these jihadists inside the Bataclan, who were subject to beheadings and dismemberment, eyes gouged out, and all the rest of it. We were not supposed to learn that, and only did, you know, coming out seeping from little shards of information brought out by various brave observers.
Let me just ask you about this, Dinah, because I comment on it in my commentary today about this very topic. I fear that in addition to misleading us, of course, and therefore reducing what the military calls our situational awareness, and obviously eroding confidence in our officials if they're dissembling, or to put a fine point on it, lying to us, it also, I fear, is emboldening the enemy. And again, maybe the enemy wasn't at work here. We'll see. I hope the investigation will have the integrity to come to that conclusion if that's where the facts lead. But if not, so be it. But in the other hundreds of cases, we need to be able to say, this must not stand. And instead, to the extent we're dissembling and all the rest, I fear that the enemy is encouraged to believe they can continue to do this, and worse, with impunity. Hey, speaking of all of this, Dinah, I did want to pivot to another sort of related topic. One of the reasons, certainly in the United States, why we are not allowed to have these sorts of conversations increasingly, that self-censorship, if not, you know, overt censorship, is at work, is because so-called civil rights organizations have been essentially enforcing Sharia blasphemy restrictions. I'm thinking of specifically the so-called Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization which has some $500 million in its bank accounts, giving live course to the poverty point, but also the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. And you've thought hard about sort of this red-green axis between these kinds of leftists on the one hand of the SPLC sort and Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood Hamas front, CARE, on the other. When you hear people associating themselves with these groups, when you hear people like Ilhan Omar, for example, raising funds for them, and describing them as just, you know, protectors of civil rights of minorities, what do you make of it?
Well, it's nightmarish. It's kind of a nightmare because it reveals the extent to which Americans have lost their understanding of what threatens them from within. I mean, once upon a time, CARE's activities as a front for Hamas would have been at the very least deemed un-American. I use that word deliberately, hearkening back to the investigative efforts, the information gathering efforts of committees on Capitol Hill under the rubric of the House Un-American Activities Committee and others that were looking into the propaganda activities and organizational activities of groups that were determined to bring down this government, subversion and worse.
And you've documented this brilliantly in American Betrayal. And I think to anybody who wants to cavil about, oh, this is just conspiracy theorizing or McCarthyism, I mean, Dunyan West, you have actually pulled the facts together, documenting these enemies within of the past and the fact that there's a lot in common with the enemies within at the moment. We ignore that at our peril, don't we?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I would say that, you know, documenting it was actually rather easy once you realize where to look. It was documented. It was here. What the tactical assault on the country really went to the heart of destroying that counterintelligence sensibility, that sense of self-protection.
I call it national security mindedness at some level.
Yes, that was stripped from us with words like McCarthyism, with assaults on the truth tellers and demonization, isolation, and destruction.
Diana, we are over time. Thank you so much for the great work you do and for sharing your insights with us on these really topical and important points. Thank you. God bless. Next up, we'll speak with Yoram Ettinger right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say we're joined by a man who I frankly had hoped to see when he was here in the United States, but I've just discovered he has only just now returned from a trip in the States back to his native Israel. His name is Yoram Ettinger. He served with the rank of ambassador with responsibility for congressional affairs at Israel's embassy in Washington. He has also served in other diplomatic posts. These days, he is just a duty expert. I shouldn't say just. He is a duty expert, particularly for outlets like ours, on matters involving U.S.-Israel relations and, more generally, what's going on in the Middle East. It's always good to catch up with him, and I'm sorry it wasn't in person. Yoram, I'm glad you've made it home safe and sound. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much. It's my honor and my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you about what went on while you were out of country. I assume you voted nonetheless. Bibi Netanyahu is now once again the prime minister of Israel, with not only the election behind him, but also now a governing coalition secured, an absolute majority in the Israeli Knesset or parliament. This, I take it, you think, as do I, is a good thing? No?
It's a positive development for both Israel and the U.S., as well as the Middle East region, and it secures continued U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation. However, the point I would like to raise here is that irrespective of who would have won election in Israel, the outcome would be positive for the bilateral relations. And the evidence is that when President Trump went through game-changing decisions recently, recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, doing away with the Iran deal, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, cutting dramatically U.S. Foreign aid to the Palestinians and to UNRWA at the UN, both left and right in Israel applauded it. Both left and right acknowledge that the current ties between U.S. and Israel are at an all-time high. Moreover, facing present and future challenges, we should remember that while it was a right-leading or right-led coalition in Israel, which devastated the Iraqi nuclear reactor 1981, it was a left-led coalition in Israel, which devastated the Syrian nuclear reactor back in 2007. And certainly it was a left-led coalition in Israel which reunited Jerusalem and expanded Israeli control over Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, as well as the Golan Heights. So while domestically there are major differences between left and right in Israel, when it comes to global reality and challenges, when it comes to regional challenges, and most particularly when it comes to U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation, both left and right uphold very, very similar position, which, again, bodes very well for the future of U.S.-Israel ties.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, all I can say is I'm glad we don't have to put that proposition to the test, because one of the places, of course, where it's been a particular problem with left-wing governments in Israel, as you know better than I, Ambassador Ettinger, is when it comes to peace processes. And, well, Bibi himself, I guess, has had some moments where he has been less than I would like to have seen robust in this regard. I think, relatively speaking, the performance of the right in Israel on maintaining a clarity about the strategic realities has translated into better behavior when it comes to ideas of a two-state solution, as it's been called, for example. One of the things that I wanted to just ask you about, which bears on this, is the commitment that Bibi Netanyahu made shortly before the election to replicate in the so-called West Bank, or what has historically been known as Judea and Samaria, the annexation of some of the key territory there that is necessary to Israel's security. I'd ask you, first of all, is he going to act on that, do you think? And secondly, we know that President Trump has committed to unveiling here shortly a peace plan conjured up by principally his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and how you think that's going to be received by this new right-of-center government under Bibi Netanyahu.
Well, my first concern is that the architects of whatever process will be unveiled by the U.S. with regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict, with regard to the Palestinian issue, whatever process will not follow in the very erroneous, self-damaging formula of prior administrations who assumed erroneously that resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict would somehow also resolve Middle East turbulence. And we have seen administration after administration according the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian issue, a central role in the Middle East, which has defied Middle East reality. My hope, based on the conduct of the U.S. administration so far in the last 2.25 years, is that the U.S. will accord the Palestinian issue its due proportion, namely a very peripheral type of issue in the overall Middle East. No Arab country considers the Palestinian issue to be a primary concern, and the fact is that currently Israel ties with Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman are at an all-time high and further and further expanding, especially, not only, but especially in the geostrategic national security, homeland security spheres. And all that goes on while there is absolutely no progress whatsoever on the Palestinian issue. My hope is that whatever formula will be introduced shortly will, by the way, or may not be introduced by the U.S. administration, will not be based on the erroneous assumptions which misled prior administration. And last and not least, Washington should be aware whatever formula is introduced by Washington is going to ignite, and I would say automatically, a more expansive, a more radical, more extreme stance on the part of the Arabs, which is going to add fuel rather than water to the overall Arab-Israeli context.
Yeah, this is a really important point, but both of those that, you know, we want to learn from bad historical experience and we don't want to make things worse. And that's my real concern about Jared Kushner's peace plan, is that I think it will properly translate into worse behavior on the part of perhaps even some of the nations that have been until recently finding in various ways modi vivendi, I guess it's called, with Israel. But to this question about what do you anticipate will be done on the West Bank by Bibi Netanyahu, do you expect that he will be living up to that campaign promise, Yoram, or are we likely to see that over the side in the favor of sort of more the status quo?
All I can do right now is express my hope that the coming Netanyahu administration, which is already the fifth, this will be his fifth term as Israeli prime minister, will be based on learning from his track record in the prior four administrations, particularly when it comes to the mountain ridges of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. The West Bank is not just an area. It's a very, very strategically, centrally located strategic mountain ridge, which impacts Israel's role in the Middle East as a stabilizing force. Israel's control of the West Bank, of Judea and Samaria mountain ridge, is in many respects a life insurance for the pro-U.S. Hashemite regime in Jordan. Israel's control of those mountain ridges, along with the Golan Heights, which also is a mountain ridge, serves to constrain the Iranian, the Ayatollah's expansion from Iran into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, and probably, possibly also into Jordan itself.
Mr. Ambassador, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your insights as well as your collective service, both to your own country, Israel, and to the common interests that we have with the people of Israel in a genuine peace in the Middle East. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Michael Cutler right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Once more, we are pleased to be joined by Michael Cutler. He is a retired senior special agent in the Immigration and Naturalization Service. He worked with the Drug Enforcement Agency and Joint Terrorism Task Forces and so on in the course of a very distinguished career of public service in the uniform of the INS. He is these days a very active contributor, I'm happy to say, continuing his service to our country through myriad public outlets, notably Front Page Magazine, of course, our program from time to time, and his own, Michael Cutler Hour, Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. Michael, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Frank, it's always a privilege and pleasure to join you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted particularly to catch up with you again rather quickly because we, of course, have had this idea bruited by President Trump, it seems somewhat to the consternation of his own subordinates, but certainly to the left, big time, namely his idea that we're going to have areas in this country, whether they're sanctuary cities or whether they're states in some cases, that are all about welcoming illegal aliens, that we ought to make sure they get plenty of them because we otherwise are saddling communities that don't so much want them with the burdens in terms of, well, as you've documented so well, Michael, you know, the public safety and public health services and education system and social welfare and all the rest of it. So talk to us of what you think about what the president is evidently giving serious consideration to doing, whether he has the legal authority to do it, and whether, in fact, he will.
Well, it was done by Barack Obama. You know, he moved unaccompanied minors to cities and towns across the United States. And as a direct consequence, we wound up with many members of MS-13 setting up shop across the country, and as my friend Lou Dobbs would say, from coast to coast, border to border. But beyond that, it's kind of a matter of be careful what you wish for, you might get it. Sanctuary cities incentivize massive numbers of illegal aliens to head for the United States. I wouldn't doubt that a bunch of the people in those caravans that we hear so much about heading up through Mexico have gotten into those caravans with the expectation that if they can make their way to sanctuary cities, they're home free. So since those cities have caused this massive influx, obviously they favor it. Why in the world would they object unless, of course, they're being hypocrites?
Right. Well, that, I think, is the working assumption, certainly on Donald Trump's part. And I guess the question is, if you want to end this problem, not further compound it, you do need to have to secure the border. After all, you may be able to hoist these sanctuary city types on their own petard by providing still more of these folks for them. But you're absolutely right, Michael, that you may wind up intensifying the tractor beam effect of this phenomenon unless you do secure the border. So this brings me to the question that we talked about, I think, when you were last on, Michael, and I think it's very important to keep this in mind, too. It's not just the southern border, which is being subjected to intensified pressure from these illegal aliens, whether accompanied by minors or not. But increasingly, I'm told we're seeing this happening along the northern border as well. Is that right?
Well, it's happening at all various venues. Look, I have frequently made the point that America is not a country of four border states, but 50 border states. Any state that has an international airport lies along the northern or southern borders, or has access to America's 95,000 miles of meandering coastline, must all be considered border states, which gets us back to the significance of interior enforcement, enforcing the immigration laws from within the interior, something that has never been done effectively. And again, sanctuary cities, in fact, act in direct opposition, hobble any efforts made by the federal government's meager efforts, 6,000 ICE agents, more than half not even doing immigration work. You add to that sanctuary cities, and what you have is immigration chaos, or as John Hostetler, the Republican chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee years ago, referred to as immigration incoherence. So we're being hammered from every direction, and it's impacting us profoundly.
Yeah. This brings me to the decision that was just announced today by the Justice Department. Attorney General William Barr has apparently ordered the suspension of the practice of giving bail to aliens who've snuck across the border through areas not known as ports of entry. What do you make of what he's done, and what impact do you think it'll have? Will it survive the inevitable court challenge?
I think it will. I think it'll ultimately wind up in the Supreme Court. Perhaps that's where it needs to go, and the crazy stuff that local judges have done, but lower court judges have. But here's the thing. You know, I used to argue bail for the U.S. attorneys that I worked with. Illegal aliens who attempt to enter the United States without inspection, and that's who it applies to. Not the aliens who walk into a port of entry and say, I'm applying for asylum. The people who sneak in, and then their plan B is if they're caught, they yell the magic words, political asylum, and they've been getting released and disappearing. Look, illegal aliens whose true identities and backgrounds are unknown and unknowable not only pose a severe threat, obviously, to national security and public safety, but they are a high flight risk. So when you are releasing people into the country and know that you're probably not going to see them again because of the lack of interior enforcement resources, it's a game of hide and seek. They hide and nobody seeks. The best way of dealing with it is the approach being taken today by Attorney General Barr to say, okay, you sneak into the country. I don't care if you say political asylum. You'll get your day in court, but before you get to court, we're going to hang on to you and make sure you don't disappear. In fact, by the way, the Border Patrol agents refer to the notice to appear, which is the legal instrument that they're served with. It's the equivalent of a summons. Sarcastically, they call it a notice to disappear. So I think that what the Attorney General is doing makes perfect sense, and it's consistent with the problems that we're facing.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll help ameliorate them in, among other ways, reducing this tractor beam effect, as we called it a moment ago. Let me ask you one other thing. I know on this program and elsewhere, Michael Cutler, you have been warning about the problem of fentanyl. And I think you were among those who have coined the term that it's really a weapon of mass destruction, a sort of chemical weapon being wielded against our people. And I wanted just to note that this now seems to be an idea that is being embraced by the government of the United States itself. And it's been pointed out that Xi Jinping, whose country China is the principal source of this toxic chemical substance, Xi Jinping promised to cut off the further importing from China of fentanyl some time ago, hasn't done it. It's been pointed out on this program, among other places, that he certainly has it within his power to do it if he wanted to. This complete Orwellian control that he exercises over the people of China now with this so-called social credit score surveillance system would enable him to do that. So what are we to make of this? Is this just further evidence that China is engaged in actual warfare against our country, using, in this case, a weapon of mass destruction known as fentanyl?
It's a multi-front war between the espionage, the construction of the artificial illegal islands, and then militarizing them, threatening us if our military assets get too close. The drug trade, they just had this woman at Mar-a-Lago attempting to sneak in, apparently, and would appear involved in espionage. Again, we'll see how it plays out. Look, I don't know how we take an adversary like China, give the most favored trade status, and we finally have a president who pushes back, and all that Wall Street can worry about is quarterly earnings report. America's survival is on the line. We have a president who seems to really understand the issue better than we've seen in many administrations. He needs the support of the American people because he's doing the right thing.
Well, amen to that. But just a closing thought on fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction and what that represents in terms of a specific threat vector?
Absolutely. I mean, look at the carnage. 70,000 people died of opiate overdoses last year. How many directly attributable to fentanyl? Plus it fuels more violent crime and so forth. It's absolutely a weapon, and the carnage is horrific.
It is indeed. We have to let it go with that, my friend. Michael Cutler of the Michael Cutler Hour, former special agent, senior special agent in the Immigration and Naturalization Services. Thanks for your past and continuing service to our country and that you particularly render here. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.